Thank you, Sybil, and thank you all for coming. I'm going to talk about three different things today, and it's going to all center around this question of the Armenian Genocide. It would have been almost unthinkable 15 years ago that Armenian and Turkish and Kurdish and other scholars would have sat down together to discuss in an academic setting the traumatic last years of the Ottoman Empire. It's really unthinkable. Yet the last several decades have witnessed a profound shift in the way we have been thinking, meeting, and coming to a kind of consensus on what happened in 1915. This vexed question of the events of what we will call genocide and mass killing in the Turkish Empire is related, in my understanding, to the emergence in Turkey of a vibrant civil society, to the opening of negotiations in Turkey with the European Union, the possibility of Turkey's entry into the Union, as well as the courageous forays by individual Turkish scholars and Armenian scholars to investigate the fate of the Armenians. I would say that at the moment, and I'll talk about this in some detail, there is a fragile understanding of what happened, though there is also a possibility of backsliding, of moving away from understanding. So we've created a sustained dialogue over these years. At the same time, there is a backlash that could undermine it. For all of the success of the efforts of what we will talk about, the workshop on Armenian and Turkish scholarship, and these courageous endeavors of a small number of Armenian, Turkish, Kurdish, and other scholars, we have to remember that there have been setbacks, like the murder of the courageous journalist Hrant Dink 5 years ago. Hrant was a member of our group. In more recent years, there has been a new wave of very subtle, denialist literature on the genocide that's presenting a new challenge to these historians who have been convinced for a long time that 1915 marks the first major genocide, at least in or near Europe, in modern times. So what I'm going to do is argue three major points about three major developments since the late 1990s that have changed in positive ways the public and scholarly views on the genocide, and have indeed turned these distant events into a contemporary weapon in the acute political debates currently raging in Turkey. So there's a historical aspect to this, and there's always a contemporary political aspect to this talk. I'm going to begin with a discussion of the emergence of this Armenian-Turkish scholarly dialogue. I'm going to tell you a bit about the tentative consensus on the events of 1915, which have emerged. Then I'm going to briefly review developments in Turkey since the coming to power about 10 years ago of the moderately Islamist party AKP, the Justice and Development Party. And finally, I'm going to illustrate and try to evaluate a complex imbrication of the Armenian question with current Turkish politics, most importantly, the Kurdish question. So I have a lot to do, but I'm not going to keep you here all day, I promise. First of all, Armenians and Turks learning to speak with one another. Years ago, I was at a meeting in New York organized by one of the political parties, the Armenian Revolutionary Federation, the Dashnak Suchun, to question some of the efforts we were making talking with Turks and trying to come to some scholarly consensus. And I had been pilloried for a long time for making this effort. You know, Sunni is worse than a Turk. Davacane, you know, he's a traitor, because he was trying to create this dialogue with my colleagues. And my response when I was first introduced at this meeting was that Armenians first had to learn to talk civilly with one another before we could even begin, and we're not so good at that sometimes, we can talk with the other. But things have developed, and I'm much more enthusiastic and optimistic today than I might have been at that time. Because true understanding of what happened in 1915, of how the modern Turkish state was created, and how both historic Armenia and Kurdistan were effaced suffers, as we know, from a disputed and distorted history that's itself been battered by professional falsifiers and government interference. And yet, I'm going to say, and here I am always, as a leftist, an optimist, there are rays of hope. Because there was this small group of, I would call them very courageous, progressive Turkish intellectuals who were willing to work together with Armenians, Kurds, and others, who have now repeatedly spoken out publicly in Turkey, in publications, on television, about the deportations and massacres ordered by the Young Turks. Although the question of the Armenian genocide is hardly the major problem facing present-day Turkey, and you can think of all the problems they have over there, the Kurdish question, Cyprus, Turkey's application to enter Europe, whether people can dress in certain appropriately religious ways, the arrests of countless journalists and activists, all of these things, civil-military relations, etc. Still, the Armenian issue, as small as it might be in the minds of some, not Armenians, in fact, has become symbolically extraordinarily important and, in fact, erosive and corrosive of certain kinds of Turkish nationalist understandings of their own history. For Turkish intellectuals, this issue of Armenian genocide has become a way to develop a critique of the Kemalist nationalist approach to history and Turkey's future development. For Turkish intellectuals, the example of Hrant Dink, the martyr to our movement, remains a powerful model of political engagement through simply stating the truth by not running away from the horrors of the past, but by exposing them. For Turkey, the genocide and the struggle against its denial have opened up a powerful, unstoppable discussion which is illuminating a way forward toward a multicultural Turkey that embraces the positive sides of the Ottoman past while refusing to whitewash the darker aspects of the old empire. So ironically, the Armenian question, which so many tried to bury, today, once again, has become a test of freedom of expression in the new Turkey. Now, my own experience with the dialogue with the Turks occurred in early 1998. I was invited by a former graduate student from Michigan to come and give a lecture at Koç University, a private English-speaking university in Istanbul. And he suggested that I come and speak about the Armenians. Now, given the position, the political position of the Turkish government at the time, that no genocide had taken place, and actually with laws in place that insults to the Turkish state were punishable by imprisonment, this seemed a bizarre and even dangerous suggestion. Yet, it was also an opportunity, and I couldn't turn it down. So I consulted with some friends, mostly with my Turkish friend, Fatma Müge Gürçek, a historical sociologist at Michigan. And I said, Müge, what do you think? I mean, if I go and I give this talk, etc. And she said, oh, you should go. And don't worry. If anything happens, we can get you out. Now, that was not the kind of assurance that I was looking for. My mother wasn't too happy about it either. But as someone who has long advocated intellectual exchange between Turks, Armenians, and others, on this issue, I decided to go. And I was shocked and surprised and pleased by the reception. The lecture went extremely well. I was mostly impressed by the students, about several hundred students. Some faculty members walked out. Others read newspapers or seemed to hide themselves. But the students were very receptive. They asked all kinds of interesting questions. They didn't seem to know a lot about these subjects. It was quite extraordinary. And I was very excited. They asked me, for instance, about Armenians, how Armenians in America think about Turks. And I had to say to them, well, most Armenians in America hate Turks for what they'd done and for the continual denial. And that this denial has caused pathological responses by both Armenians and Turks, including terrorist attacks. And the only way to move beyond the pain caused by repressed memories, it seemed to me, was to face what had happened. I said also that Armenians in America would be surprised that such a talk had happened in Turkey, that it could happen, and that you were asking these kinds of questions. At one point during the questions and answers, I mentioned that my mother's father had come from the central Anatolian town of Yozgat, that my mother's mother had come from Diyarbakir, which we Armenians call Diklanakert, a city now largely inhabited by Kurds. I told them my grandparents had left Turkey after the massacres of 1894, 96, and 1909. But of all the relatives left behind in the Ottoman Empire, almost all were murdered during the genocide. I will never forget the stillness with which these personal remarks were received. My voice seemed to go out into the auditorium and never return. I thought we have struck a nerve. So when I came back, I talked to McGay, to Kevork Bardakshan, to others, to friends, and we decided to form this thing called the Workshop on Turkish-Armenian Scholarship. We had our first meeting in March of 2000 in Chicago. And since then, we've had 8 meetings in all parts of the world at various universities, including Berkeley here in California. And eventually, a book appeared last year that Sebu mentioned, A Question of Genocide, Armenians and Turks at the End of the Ottoman Empire. But even more remarkable than what we had done was that many Turks and others in the Turkish Republic held their own meeting after that at Bilgi University and talked about these subjects even as the Minister of Justice was trying to close down that meeting. So this was an extraordinary resonance of this little movement. Now, what I think was accomplished intellectually by this dialogue was that we first of all challenged and changed some of the terms of debate around the issue of the genocide. When we began, the field of scholarship was circling around what I would call a rather conventional narrative that was fraught with politics. When embattled scholars, either largely Armenians, I would say at that time, presented the available evidence to demonstrate that a genocide had occurred, they were routinely confronted by a state-sponsored campaign of denial, either that such massacres and deportations had in fact taken place, as insinuated by Armenians, or that they were nothing more than a civil war, or the justified, legitimate repression of rebellion by the Ottoman government. So you had in that narrative a contest between what one side was asserting was the truth, and on the other side, a barrage of denial. And the politics involved the need for recognition, either by states or the international community, that such a genocide had taken place. And largely, it was a two-sided story. It was about Turks and Armenians. It was about perpetrators and victims, with the Kurds largely left out. And for historians, without much complexity, because it was a very Manichaean, black and white picture that was drawn. Now, in the last decade, in large part, I would say, but not only, because of this Watts dialogue, we call our workshop Watts, there's been a radical refocusing of the issues. First, an enormous amount of research has occurred, both by members of the group and outside. And the evidence that's derived from the original archival sources, from published documents, from memoirs, diplomatic and missionary reports, overwhelmingly, incontestably points to an effort by the Young Turk government in Istanbul to rid the besieged empire of what they perceived to be a threat to their very existence. And they were going to accomplish this by rendering the Armenians in particular, but also to some degree Assyrians, Greeks, and other Christian populations politically and culturally impotent. Initially, the intellectual and political leaders of the Armenians were rounded up in the capital. This occurred on April 24, 1915, the day that is still commemorated as Genocide Day. They were deported to detention centers, and most of them were eventually murdered. The way I put it is, they decapitated the Armenian nation by taking away its leaders, its politicians, and its intellectuals. Then Armenian soldiers, some tens of thousands, which had been recruited in the Ottoman Empire, were demobilized, formed into work battalions, and eventually disposed of. The muscle of the Armenian people were gone. Later, women, children, and older people were told to gather their belongings, sell their properties, and march under guard through the mountains of eastern Anatolia, ending up in the Syrian desert of Derzor. Along the way, thousands were cut down, the Euphrates ran red with blood, and at the end of this grueling march in those deserts, further killings took place. At the end of this process, 90% of Armenians in the Ottoman Empire were gone, either murdered, starved to death, driven from their ancestral lands, or assimilated into the Muslim population. So, by the time this evidence came out and the various books and articles were published, this unearthing of the past made it much more difficult to deny what had happened. The past would not disappear. Voices could not be silenced. Rather than play on the field set out by Turkish deniers, that is, fight the struggle, the good fight against denial, scholars had simply moved on, maybe made an end run around that issue, and worked on the evidence that was emerging from the archives, including Turkish archives, by the way. The Armenian issue, at the same time, moved beyond the Armenians. In Turkey, the question of genocide became a way to re-examine the entire story of the founding of the Turkish Republic, to re-examine the Kemalist national narrative itself, without naming it as such, and bringing in questions of present-day politics, namely other repressive and violent acts, most importantly, against the tens of millions of Kurds. So, we lost control of this issue. 1915 became an intellectual ally of the democratizing project of the moderate Islamists, the AKP, at least for a time, and eventually, more powerfully, of a radical critique of the Islamist program as well. Allied with the Kurdish question, the Armenian genocide issue became a touchstone, testing one's dedication within Turkey to a profound democratic transformation of the Turkish state. A second area that's important from that came out of our dialogue, I believe, is that we also looked at causes of the genocide, why genocide had occurred, a very important question. Now, it's very interesting that before we started this, I remember being told by a very prominent Armenian scholar, don't try to explain the genocide. If you try to explain it, you will rationalize it. You will make it explicable, and then it's justifiable, perhaps, in some sense. So there was a care about not moving to the question of causation. But we needed to talk about that question. We were convinced most of the scholars in this group, including Turks and Kurds, used the word genocide quite freely. Those who resisted the word genocide, and there's lots of technical questions why you might, because the various discussions and debates and definitions of genocide are quite murky, they were met by a very interesting answer or response from our resident philosopher, New York University philosopher Paul Boghossian. Someone said, we don't want to use the word genocide, even though we agree that there were killings, mass murder, deportations, etc. And Paul said, well, let's see, we all agree that these deportations and killings took place. We've agreed and we've shown evidence that they were ordered, initiated, organized, and carried out by the Young Turk government and its agents. We understand, thirdly, that the target of these brutal policies had been defined, named ethno-religious groups, Assyrians, Armenians, etc. If, he asked rhetorically, you accept that they were initiated by the government, that there was this mass killing, and that there was this targeted group, and you still don't want to call it genocide, then you give us the word, because that is the word. So how did we, what kinds of conclusions or findings did we find, and what about motivations and causation? On the motives and aims of the Young Turks, as well as the timing of their decision to deport the Armenians, major Armenian scholars had argued that the massacres of dissident minorities had always been a consistent Turkish practice. That is, that the Hamidian massacres of the 1890s, the killings of some 20,000 Armenians in Adana in 1909, were precursors and were connected to the genocide. The genocide itself was a premeditated event, also planned long before World War I. But as we examined the evidence in our meetings, it became clear, and most of the scholars in Watts agreed, and this goes against some of the earlier Armenian views, that the various massacres, 1894-96, 1909, and 1915, were discrete, were different in kind. The genocide was far more radical, far more revolutionary, far more eliminationist than the Hamidian massacres had been, which were a kind of prophylactic brutality to keep Armenians in their place, to stop them from revolting or appealing to the Western powers, 1890s. The genocide was nothing of the kind. It was to get rid of Armenians as much as possible, render them impotent, unable to resist again. A very different kind of event. Therefore, if these events had been linked, if there was a consistent Turkish policy, then you could make an argument that there's some essential Turkish quality, some terrible Turk that always does these kinds of things, that this is a way of ruling their empire, brutal as that empire often could be. But if you disaggregate these various events, and they're distinct, then you have a different kind of explanation that has to be sought. And the genocide itself then became much more a contingent event, occurring in a particular historical conjuncture of World War I. And that had to be examined. And as you examine the genocide, messy as it was, one came to the conclusion that this was, in some ways, like the Holocaust, a series of rolling, ongoing radicalizations of policy that followed particularly the catastrophic defeat of Enver Pasha's army at Sarıkamış in the winter of 1914-1915. So we had to give up the contention that the genocide had been planned long in advance before World War I and realized a consistent Turkish eliminationist policy, and rather was something that occurred against a long and deep background of anti-Armenian feelings and rhetoric, against the background of what I call an affective disposition among Turkish leaders, that is, an emotional environment in which Armenians were constructed as an existential threat to the empire, as agents of Europe. Within that pathological affective disposition, this emotional response to who Armenians were and what they played that arose in the late 19th century, particularly in the 1890s and 1900s, it became reasonable, rational, quote unquote, to consider elimination. So there may have been no pre-existing blueprint for mass extermination. And yet, against this background of this anti-Armenian emotional disposition that existed among the Turkish elite long ago, look at Şükrü Haniolu's book on the Young Turks up to 1908, and you can see it developing. The war presented a particular opportunity for carrying out this most radical revolutionary program against the Armenians. A particular conjuncture that brought the Young Turk triumvirate all the way to ethnic cleansing and eventually genocide. based on a fear by these leaders that the empire and their own power was in peril. The genocide, then, was a culmination of a series of policies that over time became ever more radical until Talat Pasha and other Young Turks sanctioned, indeed encouraged, and repeatedly ordered the elimination of as many Armenians as possible. Furthermore, we concluded that had there been no world war, there would not have been a genocide. Not only because there wouldn't have been, the war was used to cover up the events, but also because the radical sense of endangerment of which I've spoken among the Turks would not have been as acute. There would have been less motivation for a revolutionary solution and political opportunities for other possible solutions. On the very eve of the war, in fact, the Ottomans engage in negotiation with the leading Armenian political party, the Dashnak Sutyun, to secure their support in subverting the Russian Empire from within, using Russian Armenians on that side of the frontier. The Dashnaks wisely refused, saying, "We will, in the Ottoman Empire, be loyal. We will encourage, indeed, our own young men to join the Ottoman army and fight against the Russians, but we can't interfere on the Russian side, where others are doing other things." But what's evident is that the Young Turks were considering a number of ways to deal with the Armenian question short of genocide. When it came, the Armenian genocide was the result of this long-term, deep-seated elite and popular hatreds and fears intensified by war and defeat, and the grandiose, fantastical intentions of the Young Turks to reshape their empire and eliminate a perceived existential threat. Notice what also we didn't have. I should mention this. This is not Kemalism avant la lettre. That is, this is an imperial moment. This is a moment of an empire reshaping itself to make it in the modern world. It is not creating a homogeneous Turkish national state that Kemal will form in the 1920s. The genocide will act as groundwork for that, right? It will make it possible for the Kemalist idea. But it wasn't in the intention of the Young Turks. They weren't going to give up the Arab lands. They were going to fight for Palestine and Syria. They wanted an empire. They were going to keep the empire, but it was going to be a more Turkic empire, a more Islamic empire, and it was not going to be the kind of Ottomanist empire that they had come to power to proclaim when they came to power. What appears in the sources then is that the Turkish panic and paranoia of an imagined danger from their Armenian subjects metastasized in the hands of these Young Turks into mass murder. And also, later, in the hands of apologists of this policy, a justification for state-ordered mass murder. Now, while this dialogue was going on among the scholars in Watts, things were happening in Turkey. And this brings me to my second point. And that is, first of all, among Armenians in Turkey. They were developing, in the 1990s and 2000s, their own ideas of their own community and their own desire to revive a sense of their place in the new Turkey. Armenians, of course, for centuries have been a dispersed people, and we don't always like other Armenians, I'm sorry to say. Odars, that is, non-Armenians, think we all are very coherent and congenial and so forth. We're all, you know, relatives and chnamis and all the rest of it. It's not quite that way. One of the communities that was most despised among diaspora Armenians often were the Bosetsis, were the Istanbul Armenians. Because why had those people stayed in Turkey? Why are they collaborating with the Turks? And so I remember, you know, myself, I would hear it growing up. So we didn't love Soviet Armenia. That Armenia was Russian and communist. My family loved them. We were Hadas Kimarkans, but most Armenians weren't going to pay any attention to them. And the Bosetsis were collaborators. So we had very differentiated ideas. And yet what we missed in the 90s was that this community was finding itself in a very, and had managed to preserve itself, and had managed to find hidden Armenians in eastern Anatolia who had been Islamized and were now being brought to Istanbul to be educated as Armenians. This was going on independently of other Armenian communities. In 1996, an orphan Armenian from Malatya, Hrant Dink, founded a newspaper, Agos, very feisty little newspaper, published in Turkish and Armenian. Other people started to discover their Armenian roots. A small publishing house developed, located now in the basement on İstiklal Caddesi, in the middle of, in the center of Beyoğlu, Aras Yayıncılık, the Aras Publishing House, which prints dozens of books in both Armenian and Turkish. By the turn of the century, books on the Armenians by Etienne Mahcubian and the bestseller Ananem, My Grandmother by Fethiye Çetin, the lawyer for the Hrant Dink family, were appearing in Turkey. The dam had been broken, the waters were moving in various directions, things were changing. And then suddenly in 2007, Hrant Dink was killed, murdered by a Turkish nationalist on the streets of Istanbul. And the response to that killing, as you probably know, was that tens of thousands of Turks, Kurds, Armenians, and others marched through the streets of Istanbul proclaiming that we are all Armenians. You know, hepimiz Ermeniyiz, hepimiz Hrantimiz, we are all Hrant. And people told me that when they saw others with those signs, and later each year with those candles, they understood they were not alone, that others also were thinking this way, but had not expressed themselves in public. And now one could express it in public. Every April 24th, there are public commemorations in Istanbul, on Taksim, at the railroad station across the Bosphorus, where Armenians were sent by train into Anatolia. So clearly, a lot was happening. And why was this happening? Part of the reason it was happening was not only because we had started this dialogue, of course, but because there were already things happening in Turkish society as well that could allow this dialogue to resonate more broadly in the public sphere and in the civil society. During the years of the Cold War, you might remember this, some of you, Turkey was a state, a staunch anti-communist ally of the West. It was a member of NATO. It was touted for its particularly fierce fighting ability and its commitment to Westernization and secularization. Kemalism was, for many Western political scientists, one thinks of Dankard, Rustall, and others, to be a model of what modernization meant. And remember that modernization was the dominant paradigm for understanding development and anti-development in those Cold War years. Everyone eventually, historically, evolutionarily, would end up being like the United States. The fact that Turkey happened to be authoritarian, often ruled by its own military, was fundamentally undemocratic. That was simply the price that the West had to pay for loyalty to the anti-communist cause. In this Turkey, in this Kemalist Turkey, creating a new Turkish nation with a new alphabet, a new language, Yeni Türkçe, they had a very specific and quite rigid ethnic and national policy, a nationalizing policy. Indeed, in the words of Şener Aktürk, one of my former students now teaching at Koç University, Turkey was basically an anti-ethnic regime. And it had been consistently that since the founding of the Republic in 1923. Turkey was radically assimilationist, even more than its model France, with no official designation of ethnicity, even though about 15% of the population, possibly much more, were not ethnic Turks, but Kurds, Armenians, Alevis, Jews, Laz, Greeks, Arabs, and others. Ethnically, officially, ethnicity was invisible. The constitution said that every person is tied to the Turkish state, citizenship, ethnicity, all were assimilated. Assimilation was the dominant policy of this government. Officially, there were no Kurds in Turkey. They were mountain Turks. And only in the 90s, with the rise first of the Welfare Party, which was a first mildly Islamist party, and eventually with the Justice and Development Party, AKP, were some of these elements allowed to speak their and express themselves. So Turkey today is moving through a very radical social and political change. It is an unusually vibrant and contradictory society. And imagine this, Turkey is a country of 78 million people. It's the 17th largest economy in the world. It wants to become one of the 10 biggest economies in the world. It's very ambitious, it's very self-confident. It wants to play a major role in the Middle East and in world politics. And it has an extraordinary leader, for better or for worse, in its prime minister, Recep Tayyip Erdogan. Erdogan, in the last 10 years, has, as many of you I'm sure know, pushed through a number of legal and constitutional reforms, which have made Turkey a far more open and democratic society. Now, many people are suspicious of the AKP, and of their Islamist program. For it's true that this party, fundamentally, Islam is part of their public and self-identity. From my reading, it appears that their leaders and their constituents take Islam very seriously, that they have genuine concern for the fate of Palestinians, ordinary Syrians, Turks, and other Muslims living in Europe. Sometimes they get a little lunatic or a little too ambitious. Some AKP intellectuals have privately even talked about taking back Andalusia in Spain, which was once theirs, or avenging the İkinci Viyana Kuşatması, the Turkish defeat before the walls of Vienna in 1683. It's not going to happen, but they do talk about it sometimes. Islam, of course, is part of Turkish society. It's been marginalized under the Kemalist regime, and it's now raising its head and wants to come back. And it has this powerful spokesman, Prime Minister Erdogan, a very, very charismatic man, great speaker, but someone, for good reasons, who people fear has authoritarian tendencies. He's very pragmatic, he's very calculating, but he can also be highly emotional and very suspicious of others. One of his close colleagues put it this way: Tayyip Bey believes in God, but he doesn't really trust him. And he's a politician full of surprises. First of all, he's made it easier for intellectuals and others to talk about the dark spots in Turkish history. One of our colleagues, Halil Bey, Halil Bertay, once told me, I asked him, I said, Halil, can you now, is it easier to talk about the genocide and so forth? And he says, oh, you know, Ron, unlike 10 years ago, I no longer get death threats. And last year, Erdogan made a public apology for one of the great tragedies of modern Turkish history, the Dersim massacres of 1937-1938. So in one way, it was in this period of democratization, of the opening of civil society, of the period of hope and optimism about the possibility of moving into Europe, that this dialogue about the Armenian question itself was tolerated and became part of a public discussion. So those two things are linked. Now, in recent years, in the last 2 years particularly, ever since the June 2011 elections, there has been backsliding. The Kurdish militants have again renewed their insurrection. The government responded with massive retaliation. But at the same time, as difficult it is, and there are more journalists arrested in Turkey than any country in the world, and activists who are even loosely connected with the Kurdish question have also been in prison. Even so, at this very moment, and one doesn't know where this will go, one, there are discussions about a new constitution in Turkey, and two, there are negotiations going on between the imprisoned leader of the Kurdish resistance, Abdullah Öcalan, and the government in Ankara. So things are changing. Keep your eyes open. Things are happening. Where in this new constellation, then, does the Armenian question and the genocide figure in? In very interesting ways, Armenians and Kurds, that is, this question of the Kurds, which is the really important question of Turkey's future, and the Armenian question, which is important for Armenians and for the whole democratization process in Turkey and so forth, these questions have been linked. First of all, if you travel in Turkey to what was historic, what is historic Armenia, you will find Kurdistan. Those lands of Van and Diyarbakir, Kars, Malatya, all of those places that were once historically Armenia, Arakir, are largely inhabited by Kurds. And as you travel through that area, you will hear a very interesting and consistent discourse about the Armenians. They talk about the Armenians. They remember Armenians. They know they're living in houses built by Armenians. And these people, in fact, now say what they did to you, they're doing to us. You were breakfast, we're dinner. And so there's a kind of interesting discursive alliance formed between Kurds and Armenians. And one can hear Kurdish politicians talk about these things. Now, I'm going to give you one example, just to bring this to some kind of conclusion. They'll show you the way, the intricate and complex way in which these questions are linked. In November a year ago, the Prime Minister Erdogan decided he was going to raise this issue of Dersim, these massacres that took place in Dersim, which is now called Tunceli, which is a town out in eastern Anatolia. What had happened, that thousands of Kurds or Alevis had been killed in these massacres in 1937-1938. And Erdogan says, I have these documents that show what happened, and he blamed those massacres on the Republican Party, the major opposition to his party, and on its leader, Kemal Kılıçdaroğlu, who is in fact from Tunceli, from Dersim. And he said, Erdogan, in the parliament, is it me who should apologize, or you, Kemal Kılıçdaroğlu, if there's a need for an apology on behalf of the state, and if there is such an opportunity, I can do it. And I'm apologizing. But if there is someone who should apologize on behalf of the Republican Party, it is you, as you are from Dersim. You're always saying you're honored to be from Dersim, now save your honor, unquote. He went on to say, Dersim is among the most tragic events in recent history. It's a disaster that should now be questioned with courage. The party that should confront this incident is not the ruling Justice and Development Party. It is the CHP, the Republican Party, which is behind this bloody disaster, who should face this incident, and its chairman from Tunceli, that's he added. Now, clearly, Erdogan was using this in a political and partisan way. But look what happened next. In order to counter this humiliating accusation, the leader of the opposition issued his own statement and said that what Erdogan had done was simply a prelude to apologizing to the Armenians for 1915. Erdogan furiously replied, quote, you are putting me in the same basket with the Armenian diaspora? Shame on you. How dare you put me and the Armenian diaspora in the same basket, unquote. In other words, Erdogan was willing to take the veil off one dark spot in the history of Turkey, but the Armenian genocide, which inevitably is linked to these kinds of questions, was not yet to be touched. Now, there are further complications to this story of Dersim. apparently tens of thousands of people were actually killed there. Many of them were former, we'll say former Armenians from Erzurum and Erzincan who had fled to Dersim during the genocide and been protected there by the local Alevis. They in turn, these Armenians, had converted to the Alevi faith. Here's yet another strange, paradoxical turn. Many of these people died from bombs dropped by the first female pilot in Turkey, the famous Sabiha Gökçen, who was in fact the adopted daughter, an orphan, adopted by Kemal. She herself, it is said, was an Armenian orphan. And in from Bursa, when in 2004, our friend Hrant Dink exposed this possible connection of Gökçen to her Armenian origins, linking the adopted daughter of Kemal to the Armenian genocide, he was accused of anti-Turkism, and this began the judicial tribulations that ended only when he was murdered in January 2007. This close association between Dersim and 1915, what happened to Armenians and what happened to Kurds, has been repeatedly mentioned in articles in the Turkish press. It's impossible at this point to avoid the implications of these connections. Governments have often proclaimed that 1915 should be left to historians. And historians, in turn, have attempted, as we did in Watts, to move away from politics in order to establish an accurate, balanced, objective record of the past. But I probably don't have to tell people in this room that you can't completely excise history from politics. History, of course, is a key determinant of the political landscape. It's not accidental that history was always contested and always closely controlled by the Soviet state. As the question of both the Armenians and Kurds forces us to remember, politics and history go together. Learning about the end of the Ottoman Empire with all its horrors and investigating the turmoil that led to the formation and foundation of the Turkish Republic can be something that can remain hidden and distorted and therefore pathological. Or learning what happened can be part of an emancipatory project for Armenians, Turks, Kurds, and other marginalized and silenced groups in the Turkish Republic. Now that history is going to make all of us uncomfortable. Facing the facts requires courage. Looming ahead, in fact, is the anniversary, 2015, of the 100th anniversary of the genocide. How will Turkey deal with that centennial? How will Armenians deal with it? Are we ready to reconsider our ingrown views, our ingrained views of each other? My own hope is that doing good history may be the first step to creating new narratives, because geography isn't going to change. Armenians and Turks and Kurds are going to live for the rest of time right next to each other and together with each other. Only by elaborating new ways of telling stories of this terrible past, only by exposing the foundational crimes on which modern states have been made, can we imagine that we will be able to live together in the 21st century. Perhaps we can learn to appreciate anew the kinds of living together while remaining distinct that marked empires of the past. Empires were not assimilating, homogenizing nation states. They maintained difference while different peoples lived together in the best of times. Not accidentally, the study of empires has gained new relevance in our globalizing world as we question the narratives and inevitability of the nation state. This is becoming indeed a growth industry among scholars. Maybe that's the starting point. for a new post-national imaginary that questions the right of so-called titular nations to possess their own state. Maybe these narratives can interrogate and undermine the very notion of exclusive sovereignty. We're still trapped in 19th century conceptions of space, place, and culture overlapping and limiting each other. We need, particularly young people, need to struggle to overcome the dominant framings passed down to us by the discourse of the nation. Maybe that is a potentially emancipatory legacy of the late Ottoman destruction of the Armenians. Thank you.